House File 2531 to order. And I think we'll go through the side-by-side first, so we have some idea what we're talking about, and take it from there. Matt?
So, Madam Chair, there is a side-by-side summary in your packet, and then as well as the side-by-side language. A number of the sections in the side-by-side are identical, but I'll walk through them real quickly so you know what's in there. And then, yeah, I'll highlight the section that has some substantive policy differences.
I don't, Madam Chair, I don't have that. That's correct, I don't have that.
Laura, do you have extra copies of this? Otherwise, I have extra copies.
Yeah, I only have.
Yep, all I have is this.
Side by side, but not.
You can work on the summary. It seems like it's got, you got some other staples on it.
Oh, yeah, I do have them, I do have them here.
Senator, do you see that there's staff have one maybe over there?
That'll be the first time today that I.
Nope.
There you go. Thanks, Jim. Throw one on Jeff.
There you go.
Thank you.
If you could, for the public, if you could go make copies.
Yep.
Do all the senators have a copy of the summary?
Yep, thank you.
So, Madam Chair, again, I'll walk through, you can use the summary or the language side by side. What I'll do is just walk through the identical sections quickly first, and then at the end, I'll come back to the policy differences.
Okay.
So the identical sections begin on page R1 of the side by side. House Sections 1 and House Section 2, as well as Senate Sections 1 and 2, are technical phrasing updates to conform the language related to certain financial limits to the way that the language is phrased in other sections of Chapter 10A. Section, on page R8 of the side-by-side, House Section 6 and Senate Section 9 include some technical changes related to late filing fees. House Section 7 and Senate Section.
Can you, sorry, I'm not that quick, man. Can you, so your R8?
R8, House Section 6 and Senate Section 9. So these sections provide some technical updates.
He's on this one.
And also include some late filing fee provisions to conform to some other provisions in Chapter 10A. Starting at the bottom of R8, but mostly on page R9, is House Section 7 and Senate Section 10. These sections specify some procedures related to compliance when the board requests information to reconcile discrepancies in a campaign finance report. Currently, these sections are identical between the House and Senate, but I understand there might be some Senate proposed changes to their version of this language. Also on page R9 is House Section 8 and Senate Section 11. This is language that relates to filing common interest statements by judges and county commissioners. This is setting a new schedule for when these reports have to be filed. Judges and county commissioners were added to the substance of the law last year in 2013. On page R10, House Section 10 and Senate Section 13, again, are some technical changes just to conform the phrasing of certain financial thresholds to the way that they're phrased in other parts of Chapter 10A. Also on page R10 is House Section 11 and Senate Section 14. This increases the threshold for disclosure by associations in certain cases. Again, this is presented by the board as a technical change to conform to other disclosure requirements in Chapter 10A. Starting at the bottom of page R10, House Section 12 and Senate Section 15, updates on schedules for filing reports for candidates who do not appear on the primary ballot or who lose at a primary election. On page R12, House Section 13, Senate Section 16, again, some technical updates to reflect some changes that were made in 2013 session to reflect election segments rather than election cycles. On page page R13 of the side-by-side, house section 14, and Senate section 17, requires that the board to tell the campaign finance board to publish the expenditure limits on its website rather than formally in the state register. Also on page R13, house section 15, and Senate section 18, modify some language related to the way the board is entitled to file civil actions, if there's a need for that, based on an investigation conducted by the board. Then at the bottom of page R13, House Section 16 and Senate Section 20, is a technical update to the local campaign finance reporting chapter. So this is specifying that a local candidate or committee is only required to report the total cash on hand that has been designated to use for political purposes, and then update some terminology in that section to more accurately refer to this person's in law. On page R14 of the side-by-side, House Section 17 and Senate Section 22 repeal a subdivision of law that currently requires the campaign finance board to provide for the suspension of a public official who doesn't file an economic interest statement. My understanding is they've not ever done that. And then at the bottom of R14, the effective date, it's a technical difference that the House and Senate have the same substantive effective date, which is the day following final enactment. I'm not sure those are all identical sections in the 5SI. There are a couple of provisions that are, there's one provision that is fairly similar. I think I have to make a staff recommendation to adopt the Senate language, which can be found.
R14, I think.
Page R9 of the side-by-side. This is House Section 9 instead of Section 12. This is related to filing reports by retired judges. And the only difference here is that the House includes a reference to senior judges. The Senate doesn't include a reference to senior judges. It just refers to retired judges to be more consistent with the way the statute is written. I think the staff recommendation would be, when you get to that point, to adopt Senate Section 12.
Okay, thank you.
Manager, do you want me to go through the policy differences? Those are all the same and similar provisions. I don't know if you want to do the policy differences right now.
Did I hear you say there was one part here, was it Section Section 7, Senate Section 10, that were had the, there was a proposal for a change, even though they're similar now?
So, Madam Chair, my understanding is that there may be an amendment from the Senate conferees that would include some amendments to Senate Section 10. So currently in the side-by-side, they're identical provisions, but wishes of constitute that may change.
Okay. All right, then. So go ahead.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, there's some open policy items that are either House or Senate only provisions. R1 the side-by-side for House Section 3. This is an amendment to the non-campaign disbursement definition. The side-by-side includes two sort of policy items, but only one of them is actually before the Conference Committee. That's the on page R2, lines 2.27 to 3.2, there's an addition that provides that expenses claimed as a non-campaign disbursement for foreign travel by legislative leadership staff or by candidates is limited to only one trip per calendar year and must be justified through the submission of receipts to the itineraries and itemized expense lists. This amendment was adopted on the House floor, and Representative Driscoll offered that amendment. Also on page R2, just for clarification, on 3.9 and 3.10, there's the addition of holiday or seasonal cards to the definition of non-campaign disbursement, and that section has already been enacted into law in the online voter registration bill, so that's the committee doesn't need to take any action on that. That's already current law. And then for the other sections, there's a Senate only provision. I might have Ms. Dangle walk through that.
I'm sorry, where are we?
R3.
Section 4.
Yes.
R3.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Section 4.
Oh, wait, sorry, Scott.
What about the section?
Oh, three. Sorry. Senate Section 3. specifies that the executive director of the Campaign Finance Board is not an ex officio member of the board. This is not a policy change. That's already how things are operated. This is just clarifying it in statute. Senate Section 4 on page R3 into R4 has to do with making sure the board has the information ahead of time before the meeting. So the board may only vote on a matter if the matter was put on the agenda and supporting materials were given to the members at least 7 days before that meeting. And the board may choose to waive that requirement by a unanimous vote. Senate Section 5 on page R4 to R5 it requires the board to issue rules that will specifically outline their procedures to be followed for audits and investigations. The language says that the rules at a minimum must address 5 different things, including process for initiating and overseeing summary proceedings, how they'll dedicate staff resources and time, rights to be heard by the board, and how things will be disposed of. Under the language as it is now, the board may use the expedited rulemaking process. Senate Section 6 and House Section 4, starting on page R5, are somewhat similar, but the Senate makes several more amendments to this section than the House does. So what we did on the side-by-side was break this up paragraph by paragraph to compare them. So starting with paragraph A, it specifies that when the board receives a written complaint, the board must immediately give a copy of the complaint to the subject and let the subject of the complaint know that they may submit a written response. Then the board makes a prima facie determination as to whether the complaint alleges a violation. If so, then it moves on to the board making a probable cause determination. At this point, the parties, both the filer of the complaint and the subject of the complaint, have an opportunity to be heard and to answer. If the board finds that probable cause does exist to believe a violation occurred, then the board must undertake an investigation. Once the rules are issued under the previous section, the investigation will follow that process. Paragraph B wasn't amended either by the House or Senate, so we'll skip over that. Paragraph C, the House amends by deleting a reference to probable cause. And the Senate amends it to specify that this section or this paragraph applies only to investigations not initiated by a written complaint to the board. So presumably this would be board-initiated investigations. And this is about making sure that the subject of the investigation is given notice and an opportunity to be heard and appear before the board. Paragraph D. The House amends by adding to the list of items instead of just.
The House paragraph here deletes references to probable cause findings and then instead refers to board findings, conclusions, and orders, which I think was the board recommended language, the way they currently process these types of things.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. And the Senate side, paragraph D, goes through and specifies when things are confidential. And it also expands that list to include findings, conclusions, and orders. And it amends slightly the trigger points for when individuals are or are not allowed to disclose information related to the investigation. And then, did you do Section 5 and 7?
So, Madam Chair, so then House Sections 5 and Senate Section 7 are similar, except that both bodies delete references to findings of probable cause. The Senate adds references to determination about the information violation of the law. Page R8, Senate section 13. And also, there's a parallel section on page R13, Senate section 19. This is a data practices section that provides that the board is allowed to set up a system that allows treasurers to enter and store electronic campaign finance records online using the board's website, and then clarifies that the data entered into these systems are not government data until the data has been included in a formal report filed with the board. So there's this Senate section 8 on page R8.
Then
Senate section 19 and page R13 are sort of two pieces of that same policy concept. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that that's the entire walkthrough side by side.
Okay. All right, I think the Senate has some proposal to change a little bit of this.
We do, Madam Chair and members. And then also Senator Marty had an amendment too that wanted to get. Are there copies of this around? Or
the host members have copies of A6.
You don't have copies of A7. Which one is A6?
Lexi
just split, so I.
Could we go through the House first, perhaps? She's getting another amendment. There's a couple of them.
All right. Sure.
That'll buy a little time.
Don't do that.
If you want to adopt sections, so I know some of the sections that are identical may have some issues with the center, but there are lots of sections that are identical that I think are not. Right. You between the two bodies, so you could go through those if you want to do that.
So am I right that it's just Senate Section 10 and Senate Section 12 that we would hold back and the rest of them would be fine?
So I think I could read the list.
Sure, sure.
Sections that my understanding is don't have additional amendments from the Senate.
Oh, wow.
So on page R1, House Section 1 and Senate Section 1 are identical, and House Section 2 and Senate Section 2 are identical. So.
And should we just do the amendment?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. You get it.
That's the old one.
That's the old one.
Is there a new one?
A6, A5, A4, TLAs. It's all part of this sausage making, huh? It's
A6.
Like, what's the difference between the 6 and the 7? OAH.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Referred to 10.34A should be, yep, under 10.34 should be in there, and deleting that minimum. So this should be clean.
Okay, what we're going to do is just go through the ones that are the same on House and Senate and that don't have any additional pieces suggested that we're aware of, and I'll take care of those.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, there's going to be a list of House sections, and these are all identical sections that I understand don't have Senate amendments. So that would include House Section 1, House Section 2, House Section 8, House Section 10, House Section 11, House Section 12, House 13, House 14, House 15, House 16, and House 17.
House Section 15 shouldn't be on that list. Further action may be on that list.
Okay, so, yeah.
Remove Section 15.
Yes.
So don't include House Section 15.
Yes, thank you.
Can we make A7 bill?
Absolutely.
And was there something on House Section 6 that we don't want to do that right now?
So that one, I'm not quite sure what this amendment addresses, so we could maybe do that as a separate topic to the Senate.
Okay, I move that we adopt, and I'll just go House Section 1, 2, 8, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 16, and 17. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. A motion is carried. Now, I guess we're ready to probably hear the Senate report.
Madam Chair, you can probably also Senate Section 12. This is the exemption for retired or senior judges. There's a technical difference between the two, and the Senate's version of the language because it's more consistent with the statute. So on page R9, you could adopt Senate Section 12.
And we're just doing the retired part. So then I move that we accept the Senate Section 12. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carried. And we'll hear the Senate proposals.
Does, Madam Chair, members, is A7 amendment in front of everybody?
Yes.
Alexis, can you, will you run us through, Council, will you run us through starting with Section 3? Actually, will you read us through beginning with from the beginning of A7?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We're looking at the A7 amendment, which is very similar to the A6 amendment, which I believe many or all of you have seen, and I can talk about the differences when we get to that point. But for now, let's work off the A7 lines 1.4 to 1.10 of the A7 amendment. Add a statutory definition of what a prima facie determination means. This will be inserted into the list of definitions that's already in Chapter 10A. Lines 1.11 to 1.25 have to do with rulemaking, and the changes on these lines. Remove the authorization to use expedited rulemaking, so the board would have to use the full rulemaking process. The phrase at a minimum is deleted, so what that in effect does is say that the board may adopt rules on the following items, and then it lists those four or five items that they must make rules on. And then on 118 to 125, you see additional notice requirements. In addition to any of the notices already required by Chapter 14, which is the rulemaking chapter, the board must notify the elections committees in the House and Senate of any intent to adopt rules or any notices of hearings, when they publish proposed rules in the State Register, when a SONAR is issued, and when final rules are adopted. The next section starts on line 126 and goes through page 4, line 12, and I'll go through that in more detail. This deletes Senate Section 6 in the side-by-side and replaces it with what will now be Section 7 because we had to renumber. So you see the same section of statute is amended, but the process is different. Under the amendment, when the board receives a written complaint, they must send a copy of the complaint to the subject of the complaint and notify the subject that a prima facie determination will be made within 15 days. And it must also include a definition of what a prima facie determination means. The chair of the board or the chair's designee will then make a determination, a prima facie determination, if there is a violation. If there is no prima facie if they determine that there is no violation, the complaint is dismissed without prejudice, and that means basically that the complaint can be filed again. If the complaint is filed again, a different member of the board representing a different political party must make the prima facie determination on that time. Again, it may be dismissed without prejudice, and if it's filed a third time, then the full board must make the determination on whether there's a prima facie case about the violation. At any of these previous, the first or second filing, the chair may order that the full board make the determination and not just the one member. So if the chair or a member or the full board makes a prima facie finding, then they move on to looking at whether there is probable cause to believe that a violation has occurred. At this point, there's an opportunity to appear before the board and to be heard before that determination is made. If the board determines that there is probable cause to believe a violation has occurred, then they must conduct an investigation under the rules that they're required to adopt and other procedures outlined by law. And prior to making any findings or conclusions of an investigation. Again, there's the opportunity to answer the complaint and appear before the board. Everything on page 3 and through line 4.12, there are no changes. That's just the remaining statutory language. When we get to this next section, that's where the changes occur between the A6 and the A7. In the A6, you will have read that there were some changes about how it was the Office of Administrative Hearings that would make the determination as to whether somebody was not cooperating to provide information for reconciliation. All of the OAH language has been removed in the A7. So you'll see on lines 4.13 to 4.16 of the A7 amendment that we insert the phrase "without just cause" in three places. And what this does is to say that a person who commits a violation without just cause. So essentially, if there's a reason that they aren't complying, that provides them some safe harbor. On lines 417 to 421, we're amending the section on civil actions. Here we are reinstating the stricken language and deleting the new language on line 11. That has the effect of putting the probable cause standard back in. And at the end, we are also adding a sentence that says the board may use section 10A.34 to recover fees and penalties or to seek an injunction. It's my understanding that that's how the board either already does or would like to pursue civil actions and not under the current statute. So that cross-reference is there just simply to provide people guidance when they read that statute on what else they need to look at. Lines 4.22 and 4.23 delete section 21, and that was a deadline for rulemaking, and that deadline would be nearly impossible to meet since they can't use the expedited rulemaking process anymore, so that section is deleted. And that's the A7 amendment.
Madam Chair, there are a couple of folks that want to have some time with us to talk about the expedited rulemaking piece. One is a board member and one is the executive director. So whenever you can fit them in the queue, that would be.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Just before we get into that, you know, my question was that mainly this was on technical cleanups here. You know, there's a lot of new language in this that, you know, was never heard in our committee at all. And I'm just wondering where this came from. Is there a Senate bill? Or why wasn't there a House companion? I mean, what was going on in that process?
We, Representative Rudall and Madam Chair, it was a process on the Senate floor. Senator Newman and I met many times to try to clean up some language and knowing that it would be here. And matter of fact, even after the fact, saying we're coming into conference committee, there was still some cleanup language that we had as of even this morning, I believe. We were still having some questions, but that's the process of it, Representative Rudall. And that's where
so there's no drafted law or a bill or anything on this, is there?
Not on some of the technical, not on some of the current changes that are there right now. So.
All right.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Senator.
The ongoing discussions that Senator Hoffman and I have had had to do with changes in some of the wording. We've also met with the board, the executive secretary, and one of the board members, and they've had discussions. And there was an agreement between Senator Hoffman and I that we would not try to change this on the Senate floor. We would rather address it in the conference committee. So it has been a bit of a working process, but that is what has occurred. And as we get into the meat of the A7 amendment, I will be happy to discuss the changes.
I've got to make an announcement on the House floor. Okay. I'll be right back.
Congratulations, by the way. It's cheese day, isn't it?
It's cheese day.
Cheese
that's
burgers.
That's why they lift the chandelier today.
Is this cheeseburger day?
It's It's the only day.
Cheese.
Not cheese doodle day. It's cheese. It's real cheese day.
Cheese.
That's
all
funny.
Cheese. Should we give people about this or should we move on to
It's up to whether you want to put everything on the table before we start taking testimony or if you want to do testimony as.
I just said I'd hear it, yeah.
You know, I think we should lay everything on the table.
Okay.
And did you have anything more then besides this amendment?
No, the, Senator Marty had one, right, that he wanted us to hear in conference.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, there is another amendment, but it's still being copied and brought up. So perhaps we could do the House amendments and circle back to that one.
All right. So then, this is the House proposals or the edges?
They are passed out already. And if you want to just report to them by any, perhaps Representative Helgerson can talk about the House file.
I don't have a copy.
It should be in your packet. There's perhaps I'll give you a copy.
All right. Madam Chair,
yes.
Maybe it'd be wise for us to just lay the Marty amendment since it's not up here and just keep doing what we're doing. Maybe lay it over till Monday if that's would be okay for the chair.
I think that's all right. We maybe have more time for everything.
No, I don't think so. These are all the House amendments.
Oh, okay.
We'd like to the House file or bring House file 1961 to the table, which has been passed quite well by the full House, and wasn't heard in the Senate, I don't believe, but it has a strong backing in the House. So, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill, and my Senate colleague that's brought this to the Senate is Senator Ekins. And I believe there are a few differences between the bill that's currently on the in the Rules Committee over in the Senate and this one, but they're not substantial. So I can just these are recommendations that have come to us over the many years with regard to public integrity and Minnesota's ranking with regard to public integrity nationally. In terms of how we as public officials, and it's all public officials, so it's not just legislators, report our potential conflicts of interest and report our income and how those are audited. And so this does a few things. One, it just changes the audit and investigations from a may to a must within the resources of the campaign finance board. The fact that we're permissive in our audits really makes Minnesota appear nationally as if we do not have a strong backup system for making sure that we are all following the rules of law that we are supposed to be following. And what's interesting is I really believe that we are all following these rules to the best of our ability. But when we analyze how Minnesota ranks in terms of our laws, we are far behind other states. So that's the first. The second is the conflict of interest. And again, this, I believe, brings Minnesota in line with actual practice. And so it adds spousal disclosure to our conflict, potential conflicts of interest. So the way this seems to work in the legislature, and it doesn't happen very often, is if we have a potential conflict of interest that would significantly and uniquely benefit us individually, we disclose that, and we do not vote on that issue. We would add the same expectation to our spouses. If our spouse had a unique and significant conflict of interest, we would follow the same procedure. The fact that it doesn't happen very often, I think, demonstrates that the bar is very high for what it takes to have a conflict of interest. However, this does appear, as I talk to members, to be common practice. And it's one more area. This is actually federal law, so federal public officials have to follow the same standard, and it puts Minnesota in line with federal law and puts us on slightly higher level of public expectation and transparency. It puts us on more on par with other states. And I will say other states, many other states go farther and include minor children, adult children, business partners. So this is a very small step for Minnesota. That again, I think, improves the public trust and transparency
and also is common practice within our bodies already. We also include listing of principal business or professional activity codes. If we are a public contractor, I'm sure you all have heard over the years calls for people who are public contractor, private contractor. If you hang out your own shingle, people want to know who your customers are, so to speak, or who your clients are. I believe that clients really have the right to privacy in those business relationships. But if you own a business, if you hang out your own shingle, I do think it's reasonable for the public to know. You know, the rest of us all list who our employer is, so, you know, the public, the interest is pretty transparent in most situations. But if you are a hang out your own shingle, you list a professional activity code, and those are very clearly spelled out in Schedule C of the IRS forms. And if you're an independent contractor, you're already putting a specific code on your tax returns. We remove that one step from information, so it's not the specific code. So if you are an independent contractor and you do contracting work in agriculture and you have a very specific IRS code with what within what category you do business, we take that up one level. So it's a large IRS code of agriculture as opposed to the specific codes that are listed underneath. And so that's, again, it's a step in that direction. It's a compromise between what the public is calling for transparency and what our practices are. And then finally, we make it clear that information that is gathered during an audit that is considered private information is still your information. It's still private. So unless for some reason it needs to, it's part of the findings. So that's.
All right. Are there any questions from the senators on this?
No, I'm sure. Thank you. The last comment regarding the privacy of the data, is that down section? Or subdivision 10?
10.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hobson, where do we know, or does staff know where this is clear that it went through a lot of process in the House? Do we know where it went in the Senate?
Madam Chair and members, the Senate heard both of these files, the Senate companion to the Senate House File 1961 and the other one, which I have misplaced. They were both heard by the Election Subcommittee and passed to the Full Rules Committee. And did not receive any further hearings.
1986. So, Madam Chair, Representative Halverson, I would, you know, I think it's a tough situation to not say that these aren't good governance issues, and I imagine we'll get to 1986 as well. However, by them not getting a full vetting in the Senate, for the full Senate, I'm on the Election Subcommittee, I'm at two committees at once. I'm sure if I wasn't there, my colleagues took a good look at it, and it got to rules, but it never got to our floor. And so I'm a little apprehensive about adopting these bills, if you will, without them having been heard by all of my colleagues in the full Senate. So.
I think that's happening on both ends. Both sides right now, the stuff that's coming before us has not been heard, fully vetted on either side, on both sides simultaneously. So that's just simply the situation we're in. We have our basic beginning, and we're making changes that do not fit that criteria. So we are now here the 1986, yes.
Before we move, could I ask a
sure.
question? Representative Halverson. Line 3.20, we're talking about this audit information. Can you define for me what is going to be, or what this audit data report is going to have in it? I mean, what kind of information is going to be in it? And then it goes on to say that the board may require the individual to disclose the underlying data on which the statement is based. what I'm getting at is how deep into private financial information are you attempting to get?
Madam Chair, and Representative, see, we're going to just mix all this up, right? The intent is not to get very far in terms of what is disclosed, but I think that the Campaign Finance Board would probably be in a better position to say what's actually gathered during an audit, because it's information that they're already currently gathering. We just make it clear that it's not considered public until there's any kind of report that might need.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, my specific concern is, you know, I really do not have any major objection to an audit, so long as it is kept private. But when you get to the point where you allow the board to require disclosure of the underlying data, and all of a sudden it seems to me that you're getting into some really private stuff. And I don't think that I would be amenable to getting, you know, any deeper than what we already are required to disclose, and that's, you know, we have an interest in gambling. This would open up and enable the board to look at the value, for instance, how ownership is held. Just a thought.
Just to clarify that before we go on, we could have Gary Goldsmith respond to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board. And Senator Newman, to your question, this specifically would be a required audit of an economic interest statement. An economic interest statement is required to disclose certain things that are provided for in statute. This is a very difficult challenge that would be presented to the board, because an audit means you verify that the filed document is, in fact, correct and accurate. And in order to do that, you would need to verify not only that what shows on the document is actually an interest that the official had to disclose, but you would have to make some effort to verify that the official had not omitted from the document things that should have been disclosed. In fact, that's the more likely violation that one would find in an economic interest situation. And so for that reason, the board would, in fact, have to ask a subject of an audit for things like stock brokerage reports or statements or other things. It would certainly ask verbal questions about the official to find out or to verify and audit, in fact, whether the statement was complete. And because we recognize those concerns, we put in this specific higher level of data protection than would be in existence, for example, in a campaign finance audit where all of the data is essentially already public. And to further answer your question, the audit report, I know you don't like rulemaking, but I think we would have to engage in some rulemaking to define that. I've talked with Mr. Nobles of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, who I consider a mentor and a guide on these subjects, and the audit report is the result of the audit. It doesn't disclose things that were found through discovery during the audit. It indicates whether there were violations or whether there were no findings in the audit, and does not reveal any evidence that would be confidential. If there were additional disclosures required, an amended economic statement would include those.
Madam Chair, and to just continue the conversation with Mr. Goldsmith, this would strike me as being probably the perfect example of a reason to have rulemaking. And Mr. Goldsmith is correct. I'm not crazy. But within rulemaking, assuming that we have the ability to participate and know what is being proposed, to have some rules that outline what is in this report and what kind of underlying data the board is going to be requesting seems to me to be eminently reasonable, because as I sit here right now, I really don't know what they're going to be looking for. And it seems to me that what Mr. Goldsmith has alluded to is that they would have, for instance, the authority to request that we disclose to them, say, stock certificates or a portfolio, which would indicate, you know, what the value of the portfolio is, how many shares are owned, how they are owned, that type of thing. And that would be a concern. But I also recognize the fact, you know, how does the board know that we're telling them the truth without looking at it? So to me, it's a conundrum. And would be, to me, while the public has a right to know that we have certain interests so that we are not involved in a conflict of interest, I'm not so sure that the public is entitled to know that deeply what our financial interests are.
So then I would have a question to Mr. Goldsman. Would the public actually know that depth, or would that be part of the audit that the board would look at?
Madam Chair, under an operating program, the public would not get any additional knowledge than what is already on the economic interest statement unless the audit disclosed that something else should have been provided. Also, if we were to ask for documents such as stockbroker statements, the person would be entitled to delete from those statements or redact the amounts, the values of those stocks, because that's not disclosable. The only thing we are interested in would be the number of shares, because that's the statutory criteria for disclosure.
If I may, Madam Chair, if the number of shares is required to be disclosed, and here again I think we would be in rulemaking, if the number of shares is going to be required to be disclosed, it would be a simple matter of math to determine the value. So whether it's currently in statute or not, I think that we are delving quite deeply into an individual's truly private information.
Mr. Goldsman?
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, the number of shares is actually not disclosed on the report, but there's a threshold for disclosure that if you surpass this number, you have to list the stock, and that's already the statute. And of course, you're right. But because the number is not listed on the economic interest report, only the name of the stock, during the staff review, we would be required to look at the number of shares to see if the stock should have been on the report. But if it was left off and should be on, the name would go on the report, but not the number of shares. Now, we have had similar sensitive reviews in our office, and what we have done in those cases, and I think what the rules would require in this case, is that the person or the person's representative bring the required documents to the board for review, but the board not take or retain copies of those, but rather review them and then return them to the person who's subject to the audit. We're very mindful that we don't want to be collecting documents, even if the statute provides confidentiality. We would prefer not to have the documents at all if they contain information that would be confidential to the individual. But to do an audit, we would have to at least see them.
Did that answer your questions about having, they wouldn't have the number of the stocks, they wouldn't have the value of the stocks, they just simply have the company or the entity?
Yes. But then when we get to the part that requires disclosure of the underlying data, then I think Mr. Goldsmith began speaking to the fact that the board would be shown the underlying data but wouldn't retain it. And that would be maybe helping us out of our conundrum.
Okay, and it wouldn't go to the public.
And part of my concern is while all of this information is in fact private, and I am sure the board is going to do their utmost to keep it private, I think it's a matter of fact that if you can make it private, you can hack it. And there's been many, many instances of information that has gone public that should not have. So that's part of my concern.
It's always the concern to keep things safe. This is an integrity piece.
Correct.
And it would be integrity at this level also. I think they're looking at it more than recording it, so harder to hack. But if I'm understanding it right, but Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Halverson, one of the things, and I do, the integrity side, I mean, that was the whole purpose of this bill, was to really look at the transparency and the integrity and keep it seems to be a theme this year. one of the things that I questioned when Mr. Goldsmith talked about the difficult challenge, was there a fiscal note attached to, do you remember if there was a fiscal note attached to House File 1961?
Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman, there was not a fiscal note because the bill expressly states that it's within the resources of the Campaign Finance Board. Because of that, and we did hear testimony from the Campaign Finance Board that because of the increase of budget that they've been allowed, that they didn't need to have an appropriation with regard to this.
Okay, that stays, Madam Chair, if I may, that stays within the theme of there was, you know, it was nominal finances that were going to be coming already existing dollars. So, Mr. Goldsmith, is that your understanding as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, that's correct. I explained to my board that the mandate, the must, but within available resources means that when we have choice of projects, we ought to elevate this one perhaps a little higher than some that don't have a must in the statute. And as far as the disclosure of categories of business work and so on, that's a routine type of operation that we make those changes all the time within our regular operations.
Okay. Are we satisfied with this at this point?
Madam Chair, are we going to be coming back?
Yes,
this?
We're just presenting these things on the table. And House File 1986, I have Mr. Gary, represent that.
Madam Chair, House File 1986 is a bill that's been authored by Representative Winkler in the House. This is a bill that you may remember from last year. There's a provision of the gift ban that included a new exemption that would allow for members and employees of the legislature to accept a meal at a reception or meeting given by a lobbyist or principal. If the invitation to the meal or meeting was provided to all members of the legislature at least 5 days prior to the date of the event, the gift ban meals, basically. The proposal in House File 1986 from Representative Winkler is to revert back to the law it used to be in 2013, so that there would no longer be an exemption for legislators and staff to accept free meals by lobbyists and principals.
Okay. Any comments on this right now? Representative Hoffman, you have yourself?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This passed unanimously in the House?
I don't believe it was unanimous. It was three members, I believe, voted against it.
Okay, so almost unanimously. So it did have really broad support in the House, broad bipartisan support. And it's, to me, this is a really important inclusion to keep our standards really high with regard to the gift ban. And frankly, I think that it's also about fairness because there are very few individuals or organizations that could afford to do this. The ones that could get to have the whole legislature at their disposal on their dime, and the ones that couldn't afford this wouldn't have that at their disposal. And I think that we tell a great story in Minnesota about election integrity and a great story about our relationship with lobbyists. We're not Washington, D.C., and I always feel really good when I go and talk to the public and they think that we're up here hobnobbing, and I always say, no, we're up here, you know, trading on reputations and information, and I think that this keeps that story of Minnesota very strong if we could revert to what was law prior to last year.
Madam Chair,
yes,
what was the companion, do you remember, in the Senate who held this? Was this a... You do?
Madam Chair, Senate, yes. It was Senate File 1730. It was authored by Senator Marty.
Okay.
It was heard by the election subcommittee, I believe, but not given a full rules hearing.
And Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Newman.
This provision is being proposed to be deleted. Is the one that was enacted a year or so ago. Am I correct?
Last year.
Last year.
I believe it was on the tax bill, if I'm not mistaken.
Madam Chair, it was a floor amendment.
And Madam Chair, Council, do you remember the floor amendment was that a John Marty floor amendment as well? On the Senate side?
Madam Chair and
believe it was Senator Senjum that brought that amendment.
Okay.
So we have these things on the table. Did you have, you wanted to hold off on the other one that the Senate had?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yeah, if Council doesn't have it ready, we're going to table that until Monday.
We haven't reviewed it, Madam Chair.
We offered it. We'll just hold it. Maybe we can review it this weekend.
Okay. So,
everything is on the table now, with the exception of there's a possibility that the Senate may offer another proposal on Monday. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably at this point in time it would be helpful for both the House and Senate to take these proposals back to their bodies and talk about the fact that they're being offered. Senator Hayden's concern that the Senate hasn't seen the House proposals. Quite frankly, it's the same. The House has not seen the Senate proposal that was put on the table as well. So I think it's fair to have the weekend to talk about this with our respective bodies and come back on Monday.
Okay, and
on Sunday?
Monday.
Madam Chair.
No fishing. Bring flowers for Mother's Day.
Madam Chair, I would like, one of the board members is here. There was a piece in our side of it that talked about getting the expedited, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a social worker, expedited rulemaking piece out. If we could hear from Christian Sandy and Gary Goldsmith just about their concerns and what they have with us would help us, I think, this weekend really look at it, because the bottom line is, at the end of the day, I want some transparency and accountability to what we're doing. This will help us get to that.
Yes, and they can give us some information that we need to digest this weekend also. So who would like to go first?
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and members, my name is Christian Sandy. I'm a member of the Campaign Finance Board, and we've been working quite extensively with Senator Hoffman and Senator Newman regarding the proposal to have the board do a rulemaking to clarify how investigations work. The idea came from Senator Hoffman. I think it's a good one. Just by way of background, particularly for the House members. Currently, I look at this as a lawyer, and currently, if someone comes to me with a complaint, even in an area that I may not specifically practice in, I want to explain to them what they're up against. Here's the process. Here's how it goes. And, you pull out the book, look at the rules, and you say, okay, well, you've got this many days to respond. You've got, a hearing. Here's what you're going to have. We don't really have any of that right now for the Campaign Finance Board. And so for the folks who practice in this area pretty regularly, they understand it, and they know that. But, let's think of a lawyer in Bemidji who Beltrami County DFL gets a complaint from the Campaign Finance Board, and the lawyer says, okay, well, I don't really work in this area, but let me look at the rules. And there are none. And the board staff is always very helpful when someone calls, but it's kind of nice if someone doesn't have to call. If they can just look at the rules and say, okay, well, here's your deadline. So we would like to go ahead with this process, and we've actually already started it, where two board members are meeting as part of a subcommittee on Monday. We'll be joined by a third board member next Monday after that, to kind of start looking at these meetings are all in the open, and we'll start this process of informally drafting the rules and going forward. I guess I have two requests for you. First is to please pass this bill as it is. I think the Senate language is quite good, and please give us the authority to go ahead with that, to really make it easier for people to understand, to make it more clear, and to give us the authority specifically to do with this rulemaking as it's clarified. And then the second issue, which I've had a chance to discuss with Senator Newman initially, but we haven't had a chance to follow up, so I will make myself available to him if he wants to continue the discussion. The difference between expedited rulemaking and a standard rulemaking is really where I'm hung up right now. I would like the board to be able to do an expedited rulemaking, and that's a term of art in the statute. And Mr. Goldsmith can explain the difference between the two, but it gives us an opportunity to get the rules done. I don't think these rules are particularly controversial. We will certainly make the members of the board and staff, all the meetings will be open to the public. People will be able to come and comment to us at any point. But, you know, by doing an expedited rulemaking, we'll be able to get these rules in place by the end of the year. And I think the sooner, the better, within reason. Not doing an expedited rulemaking in the statute will extend the process, I think, unnecessarily. It will create extra work for our agency, which is quite small, and we don't have much staff. And so if you could consider the expedited rulemaking, and I think Mr. Goldsmith, who's done this, can explain to you the difference between, you know, what are we losing and gaining by expedited versus non-expedited. So I'll hand it over to our executive director.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Well, they're really, and my staff is the expert on this more than I am, although I've done rulemaking, but it's a while ago. There are a couple of big differences. One is that in a regular rulemaking, 25 people, and I know there was a bill that passed on rulemaking, so I don't know if it's 25 or 50, but a number of people can demand a formal hearing on the rules before the Office of Administrative Hearings. We think and we hope that by the open process that we're having, that wouldn't happen anyway, but it can, and it delays the process and costs substantial amounts of money. We will still have, in both rulemaking procedures, you still have a formal comment period once the rules have been drafted. The drafting process that we're using, as Mr. Sandy said, is a collaborative one where everybody's invited to every meeting and comments can come at any time. However, there is a formal comment period once publication occurs. The other big difference is that for regular rulemaking, a statement of need and reasonableness has to be provided, detailing why every rule is needed and why it's reasonable. And I think in this particular case, since the rules are mandated and the scope is dictated by statute, to require a statement of need and reasonableness may be overkill. Having said that, we're willing to do either one, but certainly one can be completed, the one we're working on now, by the end of the year, and the other cannot. I also have a concern because in the back of my mind, my staff is telling me that when the legislature mandates regular rulemaking, you have to complete those rules in a certain length of time, or the authority expires. And I'm not quite sure if Ms. Stengel found something like that. Okay. It's 18 months, and that would be adequate. I was concerned that it might be too little. So, expedited rulemaking will be an open and thorough process, with plenty of room for public comment and multiple board hearings on the rules, and that would be our preference, but that's up to the legislature. I did want to comment on one part of the A7 amendment before you adjourn to leave you with some thoughts on that.
Just on this, is there a cost associated with this or any other part of the amendments that changes you have offered?
Madam Chair, as far as I know, that should not be any cost associated other than what is currently within what they typically do.
And would you agree?
Well, Madam Chair, when this was moving through committee, I was asked and I informed the author and people in the Senate that the board always budgets in every year for rulemaking. There are two costs. One is publication in the State Register, and one is review by the Office of Administrative Hearings. That has to happen even if the rulemaking is expedited. So we would use our existing rulemaking budget for this rulemaking rather than do some different rulemaking that we might have done.
All right. And Senator Newman?
Madam Chair, if I may respond to these points, I want to begin by stating that rulemaking is not something that I necessarily oppose. What I oppose is general rulemaking authority where the legislature simply says implement law or implement rules for the purposes of implementing this statute. That, to me, is much too loose. In this particular bill, there is provisions for specific rulemaking, and I do like that. As to the difference between expedited and a regular rulemaking hearing, Mr. Goldsmith has indicated there would be 25 people would be needed to request a formal hearing. The statute says a public hearing. So that's what we're really talking about, is a public hearing on rulemaking. Whereas with expedited rulemaking, in order to get that public hearing, you need 100 people. So a significantly larger number. The other thing, insofar as the SONAR is concerned, statement of need and reasonableness. Just because we have specifics that are listed as to what the rules are to be implemented, I don't think should necessarily remove the need for a statement of need and reasonableness, because what happens with it is an administrative law judge looks at that statement and makes a legal determination as to whether or not the rules that are being proposed comply with the statement of need and reasonableness as outlined in the statute. So what I'm suggesting is that...
Senator, did you want to vote on the expungement bill?
Expungement, we're asking the senators to come.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. You were doing well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you want to hold this, or do you want to...
You should come back if you can, and yep. We can get more clarified before we break.
Okay, thank you.
So is that just a vote?
That's the one up.
I think we ran out, but I can go and make more while we're...
So you said it was going to streamline the sonar plan.
So it isn't.
Hasn't been signed yet.
It's a rulemaking bill.
Oh, no, it was going to get ready to Gloria's reaction. No, it's
not.
So it hasn't
been signed.
It's going to streamline, at least in some versions, it's going to streamline the sonar.
I don't get the requirement why it matters to that we're required to do a public hearing.
I mean, their intention is to meet publicly. Is there a way to?
Well, right. Yeah. I mean, it would be different if we weren't going to what we are.
Yeah, it's so it's
schedule.
Mm-hmm. And is the board doing the rulemaking or is that?
No, it's.
It's the board that would
and
be.
And they're subject to open meetings.
That's correct.
So that would supersede the 100.
So we have to stay on that track. I think we'll stay on it anyway.
Right.
I mean, we don't want to be doing gaming in the next legislative session. Stops.
The one question.
Take one down, I'll pass them around.
Oh, your timing is impeccable. I was really starting to have a growly stomach here.
Bacon
cheese.
That's my favorite.
Those
the white ones are horseradish. Those are onion. Those are horseradish.
Oh, I think I'll skip that one. So we had a meat market.
What?
A meat market. And
which one are the horseradish?
The white.
Pure white?
Yeah.
Every day.
I'll let the other side have
it. Do you like some cheese? You have to be told what they are so you don't get into
onion?
Trouble.
Representative Erdahl knows him.
Onion and something, and
thank you for thinking of it.
That's the horseradish.
First district in Litchfield. The dairy industry is an $11.5 billion industry for the state of Minnesota, and 35% of it comes from Litchfield.
Really?
The cheese on your Tostitos, the cheese in your Kraft macaroni and cheese, your McDonald's cheeseburger came from Litchfield.
Really?
7 million pounds of milk a day.
Well, you add all the legislators up and we have a font of
knowledge.
And it was not easy for me. Once I give them the cheese, yeah. I said, should I take some down to the conference committee? They said, no. Because it goes quickly.
They said there were Senate folks down there.
I right? did. That was the problem.
So otherwise, we've got everything on the table now.
With the exception of, apparently, I think you should let it be known that the Senate may add a proposal.
Give one to the senator here.
Cheese.
Lunch.
Cheese.
It was 55-3 when I walked in there, so I think I listened to you. They needed my vote on that one, so.
Senator, you can take a slice of cheese.
Oh, thank you. Is this Bongard's cheese, or where'd you get this?
Oh, my gosh.
You can't
swear here. First district, Fieldgate cheese.
That's good. I like.
Cheese.
Oh, he might not. He got held up some.
Hayden is visiting.
Yep.
Normal for him.
We have
gotten explanations on
adding this.
Hey, Madam Chair, I think I pretty well concluded my comments.
Okay, and you would speak to your preference for regular rule meeting as opposed to expedited.
We talked about adding this.
And speaking in terms of the public there and in need of reasonableness things.
And then
I would just let Mr. Goldsmith respond to that.
Sure.
His
well,
proposing
as I said, we can do it either way. I think our process is going to be very close to the regular rulemaking. We do have in our calendar a full public hearing as well as these working sessions to which everybody on our rulemaking list is also invited. We have them in rooms over in Centennial Office Building, not in our office. But this is a legislative prerogative, and we prefer the expedited rulemaking because we can get it done before the next session starts and the budget year begins. But legislative prerogative.
And your other comment regarding the need and reasonableness statement had to do with the fact that it's already listed out in statute.
Yeah, I mean, the legislature has clearly determined there's a need for these rules because they've listed it. But I understand what Senator Newman is saying, that we would explain in a sonar, you have to explain the need for each individual rule. And so even though there's a statement by the legislature of a general need for what we understand to be fairly detailed rules guiding the steps of these processes, we would have to spell out why this particular rule is needed and why this particular rule is needed. And we do feel that, that's more than is necessary in this situation.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Goldsmith, with regard to, I know that you stated that the intent is to have the rulemaking process be very open. Is the fact that is the board making the rules, therefore the open meeting laws would apply and supersede the need for a 100-person request, or has there been any analysis about that?
We've gone far beyond the open meeting law because our working sessions may only include sometimes one or sometimes two board members, so they're considered working group rulemaking meetings. They're published on our rulemaking docket page, which is on our website. I don't have staff here, so I don't know how many people have already signed up for our rulemaking list, but we invite everybody that signed up to be kept informed about rulemaking to those meetings, and we take input from anybody that shows up. There will be and I'd have to check the schedule, I think it is in June, a formal public meeting
which will be in a bigger room where, again, we publish on our website, but also to anybody that signed up for the rulemaking informational communications, and that will be a hearing that anybody can come to and comment or ask questions. And then, of course, there's the formal comment period that occurs after you publish in the state register. And that's a 30-day statutorily mandated comment period.
Okay, so it's already very open.
We want it to be open because the rules will be better if all of the stakeholders have input. There are things that two or three staff members and two or three board members aren't going to think of. And if we can get active involvement from the stakeholders, there'll be better rules.
Okay. And welcome, Senator Haberbach. I just wanted to restate that is the difference between expedited rulemaking and the regular rulemaking has something to do with the public being there, and we just clarified that the public is involved in every step of the way all the time, as it is now. Mr. Sandy.
Madam Chair and members, just to echo that, and I think what you were saying too, Representative Lane, we aren't going to have meetings on these rules without them being open to the public. That when board members are getting together in the subcommittee that we're doing, it's been published and it will be published. When they're reviewed by the board itself, the draft, that our goal is to look over a draft in June, and then again when we approve them for public comment, hopefully in July, those will be in open board meetings as well. And anyone who has worked with Mr. Goldsmith knows he answers his own phone and he returns his calls. And, you know, we're Minnesotans here. If you give us expedited rulemaking, we're not going to pull a fast one on you and change what our plan is right now. This will be an open process. And even the subcommittee meetings, which, as Mr. Goldsmith points out, the open meeting law doesn't apply because we don't have a quorum of people there. We're still making sure that those are open meetings, and we're treating them as if they are, as if the open meeting would apply.
Is that a model for us?
Madam Chair.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, and you know, I appreciate the process by which you would do expedited rulemaking. I don't have a problem with that. But I do foresee a problem in the House where, you know, customarily legislation dealing with expedited rulemaking would go first through our Government Operations Committee, and obviously would not be doing that today. So I'm just, you know, saying now that I know that there would be some a hue and cry raised on the House floor about the fact that this didn't go through our Government Operations Committee.
And I believe that Mr. Goldsmith had something else he wanted to bring up.
Yes, Madam Chair, I wanted to comment on the A7 amendment, specifically the language on lines 4.13 through 4.16, and ask you to turn to the R9 Senate language, because I think I need to put this into context to explain why the board's original recommendation, which is the House language, why it reads the way it does. Because out of context, if you just read this section, it doesn't look like it might be doing the right thing. This is part of section 10A.28, and 10A.28 deals with penalties for exceeding the contribution limit or exceeding the spending limit. And the section, the subdivision that comes just before the one that we're talking about is called conciliation agreement. And what happens actually is we see these violations on reports. Somebody spent too much or somebody took too much from a particular donor. So these are things that are shown on reports. And so subdivision 3, which you don't have because it's not being amended, says that if the board finds, and I'm reading it, quoting it, if the board finds there is reason to believe that excess expenditures have been made or excess contributions have been accepted, then we go into a conciliation process. It says the board must make every effort for a period of at least 14 days to correct the matter by informal methods and to reach a conciliation agreement. And in almost every case, we do that because the person usually acknowledges it, conciliate, or it's a reporting mistake, and they amend the report and correct it, and then it just goes away because it's not a violation. So first of all, you have to keep in mind that before you get to this Subdivision 4 language, you're in a conciliation situation, which is an informal process, not based on a finding of probable cause, because it's very informal and it's done by collaboration. Now, what Subdivision 4, which is the subdivision we're amending, does is it picks up after the conciliation mandate fails. And so it says if the board's unable after a reasonable time to correct by informal methods a matter that where reason to believe there's a violation, and the reason we changed that language in the board recommendation is, first of all, to make it consistent with the preceding section that says if we have reason to believe there's a violation, we try to conciliate. And secondly, because in the bill now, there will be a very clearly defined probable cause hearing, which wouldn't be applicable here. So at this point, conciliation has failed, and there's still, of course, this reason to believe there's been a violation. And at that point, it says the board may make a public finding, and it wouldn't be a finding of probable cause because we don't do those at that stage. It would be a public finding. The board's language was really just to clear up language that didn't get fixed last year when at the investigative stage, instead of making findings of probable cause, we make findings and conclusions. And so this was really a technical amendment to make this language parallel to what you did last year. And then the rest, I think, the Senate does propose to modify, but I'll tell you about it anyway just briefly. In this particular situation, then, and this is the only place where the statute says this, if we have made a finding then that there's a violation and issued a penalty, it requires us immediately to sue the person. Mm-hmm. And we never do that because they pay. They always pay voluntarily, almost always. And if they don't, Section 10A.34 already gives us the right to bring a legal action to collect a civil penalty under any case. So that language, first of all, made a lawsuit mandatory when it wasn't necessary and provided authority that exists in Section 10A.34. And the last sentence about money going into the general fund, that was codified into 10A.02 subdivision, I believe it's 16. So that there's an overriding provision that says all money we collect goes into the general fund. So that was the board's recommendation on that particular section, and we'd recommend to this committee that they keep the board recommendation in the conference.
All right. Does anyone else have anything they want to say, either at the table or in the room, about where we are at this point, about anything that's before us?
Madam Chair, if I could, as long as we have Mr. Sandy and Mr. Goldsmith here, perhaps they could discuss the language regarding the procedure that they are proposing to use regarding the crime of the finding of prima facie. The procedure that we see is really it's the board's language, and it's at their request. It's, and gentlemen, I'm referring to that sort of that possible three-step process. If you could describe for the chair and the members what you have in mind, that might be helpful. As long as you're here,
Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman and members, let me take a step back and just outline so you can see how the process is going to go. And I think Mr. Goldsmith can explain specifically, although Ms. Stengel did a great job of explaining where how the prima facie works. A complaint comes into the board, and the initial determination is whether it's even something that the board can deal with, whether it's within our jurisdiction under Chapter 10A and certain parts of Chapter 211B. You know, we get a wide variety of complaints of, you know, people claiming that this, you know, this entity is engaging in activity and it's a nonprofit, it can't do that. And our response is, well, call the IRS. I mean, that's not us. And so there's the gatekeeping function initially. And that's where, at the prima facie stage, in the current proposal, it will go to one board member. And that's, you know, the board only meets once a month. And we're not compensated other than per diem. And so it's, you know, how much time do you need board members to get together for what is really just the gatekeeping function from complaints as they come in. So the complaint comes in. It's sent out to the respondent, the person against whom the complaint is made, and they have 15 days to respond, you know, just to say whether they think it sets out a prima facie allegation. I bet they're going to say a lot more, but our analysis at that point is just limited to does it set out a does allege a violation over which for a statute over which we have jurisdiction. They respond, and then I think it's 15 days after that, the board member rules is within 30 days of when a complaint comes in. So within 30 days of the complaint, a board member then, or the chair can decide if it goes to the whole board, makes the initial prima facie determination. If we say it comes to me, if I say I don't think this sets out a prima facie determination, we send it back to the complainant and we say why we don't think it does. And as Ms. Stengel pointed out, it's without prejudice, so they can refile it. They can correct the errors. If it does come back, then it won't come to me, and it won't come to anyone else who supports the same political party. So it would go to either a Republican or a non-Democrat member of the board to make that determination, so that people don't feel that you've got a board that's favoring one party or the other. If the second board member then agrees that still doesn't state a prima facie violation, goes back, the person can then file it a third time, it'll go to the whole board. So that's how the prima facie finding will work. After that prima facie stage, let's say that we say that, yes, it does set out an alleged violation, the matter will then go to the board for a probable cause hearing, and the statute requires that the board give both the complainant and the respondent an opportunity to be heard. The respondent can submit something in writing, and they can both come in. And I'll tell members of the House, I've told members of the Senate this already. It was one item that a former board member, you may know, Tom Heffelfinger, the former United States Attorney, pointed out to me that he always, when he served on the board, he wanted an opportunity to sit across the table from respondents and hear their side of the story. And so this is giving parties an opportunity, if they want to, come in front of the board. The other issue is that once a complaint is filed in front of the board and we accept it, particularly if we find that it has probable cause, the board then steps into the shoes of the complainant. And we're dedicating taxpayer resources to investigate a complaint. We're also asking a respondent to incur possible expense, certainly time, in dealing with an investigation. So before we go forward into that investigation, we want to make a probable cause determination and give people an opportunity to be heard. And then if it goes forward into an investigation, before the board can issue findings at the close of that investigation, we, again, have to give the respondent an opportunity to be heard yet again, to tell their side of the story. The other thing that's set out in the rules, which I think is a good thing, is we will be required as part of this rulemaking to set out summary proceedings that could either make an investigation unnecessary if there's really no facts in dispute, or could somehow make the matter move faster. And that's actually the board subcommittee that's meeting on Monday. We'll be discussing what options are there, how would summary proceedings work. But that's how the whole process will go. And so to get back to Senator Newman's comment on the prima facie, we went back and forth on could we have it done by two members, one done by one person. Our concern was not giving one board member veto power over complaints as they come through. And I think the process here that is set out in the bill in front of you that our executive director drafted, actually, after hearing from everybody, I think it's a good one, and it gets rid of the idea of one board member having veto power over complaints, but it also makes it easier for us at the initial stage to get complaints processed pretty quickly into that into the pipeline for how we deal with them.
No, the language in the A7 amendment is I would call it a compromise or negotiation. The board started out with a proposal for somewhat simpler language for the prima facie determination, but this certainly works for us. It's administratable. It doesn't add too much delay. It does add another 30 days before the next step, but that's just going to be built into the process, so we can do this.
Any further comments by anyone? All right. So we have a lot on our plate to come back on Monday at some point.
Monday afternoon works better, Madam Chair, for you or for others?
It would for me, but I can make anything work. And I understand that normally Saturday would be considered the Senate opportunity to chair, and Monday would go back to the House, but I'm willing to let it become the Senate's.
You're doing an absolute fine job, Madam Chair. You can. I just.
Your choice. So you can decide that.
I will.
Talk to us.
That's good.
All right. I guess that means we're adjourned for now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.